Erlon Brown, and I'm the village pastor. And this session is on Iron John male identity. How many of you have read the book Iron John? Oh, I thought there would be more people who have read it. Well, this is what it looks like. And what we'll be going through is sort of, Iron John is kind of based on The Hero's Journey by Joseph Campbell. So there's elements of, there's kind of a mixture of the two here. The Hero's Journey are kind of the titles here, and the sub stuff, the subtext is basically from, or is from, the book Iron John. And what we're going to do here is just basically kind of connect with this stuff in our lives and see how it fits for men. Now, everything on here does not totally encapsulate what's in the book Iron John, but we'll see where we go from here. And we'll open it up for discussion. This is not necessarily a book review of Iron John, so, but we'll connect with that. And any questions you have, or if anyone has any thing to say, we'll go with that. The first thing on this hero's journey, men as hero, Joseph Campbell talks about that the male journey is outward, and he believes that the female journey is inward. So we're kind of on two different journeys here. And there's also a tension in Bly's book between what he calls a soft male and a fully initiated male. A fully initiated male is a male who has gone down under, as Bly says, who has done the grieving that being a male is all about. And the soft male is somebody who has taken on the pain of women, and who has is somewhat kind of being what women want men to be, which is more soft than hard, understanding, soft-spoken, quiet, listening type, that sort of thing. Now, those things are not necessarily bad things, according to Bly, but they are things that can swallow up what it is to be male. So, I think it would be an interesting thing to run through this in our lives and see what kind of connections we can make here. The call to adventure, and then the subtitle for this is Golden Ball or Your Grandeur. Bly calls the golden ball the part of us that is that's wonderful. The 2 or 3 year old child that's curious, that's full of himself, that we once were, but that through the years we've learned not to be. Can anyone give examples of a golden ball or a grandeur? Do you know what I mean by that?
You mean the child?
The child, or yeah, the the wonderful part of you. Now, we don't have to share these, but you can write these down, and then maybe at the end you can see some you'll see some connections in your life. But would anyone like to share what their grandeur was at 2 years old? Does anybody remember what their grandeur? Actually, you can remember it by what your parents kept telling you not to do. As a child, I was very curious, and I used to love to take things apart. I had no interest in putting things back together, but I did like to take things apart. And I was always being scolded for being somewhere I didn't belong, looking at something I had no business looking at, getting into something that I had no business getting into, taking something apart that I had no business touching. That kind of thing would be what our grandeur is and our golden ball. And ultimately, it would be our call to adventure, in the sense that this is what excites us and moves us out into the world, into our journey.
Yeah, and just get on that, what you said before about, you know, this, the interpretation that men kind of go out and women mm-hmm. journey in.
Mm-hmm.
Is that saying that we're starting at the same point, or is that saying that men start down here, that women come to him, and then women start over here, and men then come out to that?
Well, all it's saying is we start equally, but we just start at very different places.
Okay.
Now, I don't know how to rate that, how to say one is up and one is down,
yeah,
or whatever.
I'm just saying, yeah. Are you, in this interpretation of growing out or growing in, is one growing towards the other?
Not necessarily. One is growing towards an understanding of self and the world, and an acceptance of other, an acceptance of difference. So that would be the call to adventure. Can anyone else think of some calls to adventure? There's an article that I wrote, by the way, called "Let My People Go: From Fact to Myth" in the recent Accent, and it talks about a call to adventure from a biblical perspective. And from a biblical perspective, you think of Moses and the burning bush, you know, that kind of thing. That was Moses' call to adventure. And in all adventure stories, there's a call. Yes, sir.
I don't know if it's a call to adventure, but I think one thing that I have lost, that maybe now I'm trying to regain, is a sense of spontaneity and playfulness, which oftentimes is slowly quenched because of schedules, priorities, and obligations and responsibilities. But as a child, there was the freedom to be spontaneous, to play, to really play, to not work, but to play.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes it's difficult when we have that time, if we even have it, what do you do with it? How do you play?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one area that I am trying to regain in my own.
Related to that maybe is playing hard, you know, and that's something that I remember. Those are times that stand out in my mind when the play was challenging, whether it was some kind of athletic play or whether it was a canoeing and hiking or something like that. For me, just personally, that is, you know, those are kind of moments when something clicks for me.
There's a thing that I was going to say. There's a kind of fearlessness that I had as a child that I miss sometimes. Maybe a naive fearlessness, but naivete is another thing that I cherish as well.
Mm-hmm.
That allowed me to do something full out without fear.
You all touched on stuff that's in this, and I'll go give me, if I lose where one of you are, we'll get back to it or remind me of it. But the part where you play, I think you mentioned where you play hard and you lose, you know, those times when you're playing as a child and you lose track of time. That's what Bly would call a wall garden. And in your wall garden is where you go, where what happened in the daily news doesn't reach you, where what your kids are doing or what your wife thinks doesn't doesn't reach you, it has no bearing on your walled garden. And what that is your sacred space. Where you go and what you, when you do something where it's just you and that's what you do. You know, for some people it's sports, for some people it's woodworking, for some people carpentry or whatever. That's a spot that that Bly talks about that that gets eaten up from us. And then that connects to what you said, because Bly talks about we eventually our society would like it if all men were company men. And by that meaning that our life is strictly sewn up in maintaining the society in this false harmony as it is, where the work you do goes strictly into the company and preparing your wife and your children to consume goods that keeps the system going. And he says a way to get away from that too is to give back to the walled garden and find stuff that you do that's just for you, that has no bearing on anything else. It's not to make money, it's not to save money, it's not to save the world, but it's for you, whatever that is.
I think one thing that, you know, that people here touched on is that a lot of times the play that we were doing, you know, when we were younger, we're playing for the sake of playing, as mm-hmm. opposed to playing if you're in sports to win at this, or you're doing something because, you know, say if you're going on a hike because you want to see Heart Lake, or, mm-hmm. you know, if you want to do this, you're doing everything for a purpose as opposed to just doing it. Mm-hmm. And I kind of get, you know, what you're saying with this, is you're working so that you can, you know, support yourself or whatever, but we kind of lost the...
Yeah, you lose that, and you have to find that. And this is very intentional. It's not accidental. The walled garden part is very intentional. And someone else mentioned something. I can't remember who it was, but I'll put this down. Bly talks about to awaken the king in us. It's not that we've lost the king in us, and the king is who we are. You know, it's not that we've lost that and that we have to go find that, which is a misunderstanding. A lot of people think you go out to find this person, but that person is there. Bly says that person is there, but that person is asleep. That person is laying on the floor asleep. And that when you get in touch with these things, then you awaken that person. That person awakes, that vitality, that energy that you awakens. And that's kind of scary for a lot of people. That's scary for our wives, for those of us who are married, our lovers, our children, the companies we work for, because nobody is going to pay you to be what you want to be. People pay you to be what they want you to be. So that would be one.
That walled garden doesn't have to be an activity, does it?
Well, yeah, but it could be any kind of an activity.
It could be reading.
It could be reading. It could be reading what you want to read. It could be reading a novel as opposed to the financial pages. You know, you read a novel for the sake of reading a novel. You don't read the financial pages so you won't go broke, you know. So, that walled garden can be anything. And then we move from there, and then that's where your grandeur is. And then we move from there into finding your own path. And then you get to the wound. And the wound is, there's this African folktale that talks about a guy who goes out hunting with his father. And his father tells him, says, wait here, and gives his son an axe and says, wait here, we're looking for a lion, and when the lion comes, you hit it. So the father left the boy standing there, a rodent of some kind comes by, the boy chops it, and when his father comes, he holds it up and says, I found the lion. And the The father then takes an axe and hits the boy and says, "This, that's no lion, stupid. That's a rat." And so he hits the boy. And then where that boy is hit is where the boy's wound is. And Bly says we all have a wound. There's some place where we've all been hit by axes from our fathers. And he says sometimes the father hits you with an axe, gives you a wound, and then the mother throws salt on that wound throughout your life. And the thing about this wound, wherever your father hit you, you know, of course that's metaphorically speaking. For some of us it's in the gut, for some of us it's across the head, for some of us, you know, it could be literally, you know, it's like those of us who have been hit by our fathers, how our fathers hit us, or where our fathers hit us, or where he hit where it hurt the most. You know, some is just being shamed by fathers, which gets you somewhere in here. You know, shame, humiliation, physical, just going upside the head, you know, and so your wound is upside the head. So that's where men have, you know, Bly talks about men having a wound. And the gift part, finding your own path, is the sense that by from that womb, that's where your greatest gift will come from. Meaning that if you get to, if your father humiliated you for being, well, you know, all those stories about muscle builders, you know, like Arnold Schwarzenegger was a, you know, a wimpy, skinny little kid, and his wound didn't necessarily come from his father, I don't know. But his wound of being weak, well, now his greatest strength, you know, is the fact that he's no longer a weakling. And that's a story you hear over and over again from bodybuilders. And many bodybuilders, the average bodybuilder is under 5'10". So many bodybuilders were short guys, and their wound was in being short, and their gift came from their ability to make up for their lack of height, you know, that sort of thing. So Bly says, be aware of your wound, because where your wound is, that's where your greatest gift to society will come from. And another way of putting that, some of the ancient sayings about thank God for your enemies, because where your enemies are, that's where your fate is, in the sense that sometimes fighting your enemies is a way of getting in touch with your gifts. And I think of people like Martin Luther King, whose enemy was white America, but he ended up giving us a great gift. And that goes on, you know, that plays itself out over and over again with many, if you read biographies of many, many old people who have achieved much in life, they all remember their wound, they all remember their enemies, and that in a lot of ways made them go out and do what it is that they do or did. And then we move from there, when you find your own path, and this part about finding our way through the maze. Now Bly calls this kitchen work. Bly calls this you know, the time when we're when we bottom out, and you know, you can think of your own lives when you bottom out, or there, you know, a good story of any good story, there's a time when people bottom out. And Bly calls this kitchen work, and you go down literally that. Mythologically, it comes from working in the kitchen next to hot coals, close to, you know, close to Hades or hell or whatever, that that kitchen type work. And then the ability to shudder. And this is very important, according to Bly, this ability to shudder. Because if you don't have that, then you become a tyrant. If you don't have the ability to shudder, is this ability to empathize, to be afraid. You see, this ability to shudder comes from seeing how horrible life can be, and actually being afraid, actually being afraid. And instead of ignoring that fear or pushing that fear down, which causes people to fight all their lives and become tyrants and killers and all the abhorrence that we see coming from me in society. Once you learn to shudder, then you can empathize with people who have to shudder. You empathize with people who you know, who have shuddered. Does this make sense to people? Is this connecting with, you know, with anyone? Can anyone connect with any of this in their own lives? Or
a quick comparison would be the some of the late night television psychology programs that literally talk about focusing yourself so intensely that you put out all of the thoughts from your mind, and that to me is walking away from empathizing. It's just shutting down, ignoring. And they might be successful in real estate or in some other endeavor, but they're not whole people. So there's a definite difference between that and this.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the ability to shudder. I think of the LA riots. And it was very scary.
Mm-hmm. For some people, NAM was that. War.
Yeah, sure.
For some men. Yeah. War is the ability to shudder. You know, you leave home, sort of a cocky 17 or 18 year old, and you get out there and you see death, you know. You know what that's like. Now, some men push that even further down and come back and, you know, beat their wives and children and drink beer for the rest of their lives. But some men, you know, it connects, and they know what that, they empathize with war, and they oftentimes turn around and fight against war. I was reading something, it was talking about generals, and it says oftentimes generals, when they retire, speak out against war, you know, because they've seen it, they know what that's like.
Yeah, that's very true. I've talked with military people, and it always surprised me, because they were more of a peace activist than I had ever seen, because they knew more about what it really was than even some of us who never experienced it.
That is usually the older ones, not the youth.
No, I met a young guy once, he was about 38, he was a colonel, and he surprised me too.
I mean like the 18 or 19 year old going into the service, they haven't shuttered yet.
No, that's like fodder for the machine. Mm-hmm. They just go in there thinking they're going to do brave things. We have to initiate wars much more.
And Bly even takes this even deeper, because Bly is very intent on men grieving and going down, you know, as far as you can go with grief and accepting that grief and accepting your part in the hell of the world. And he takes it even farther, and he talks about this story or metaphor about this guy. He's called Sleeping with the Black Darling. And he sleeps with this dead corpse, and he rolls over and actually touches and lays next to this dead corpse. And Bly talks about at some point we need to go back and find that dead corpse. We need to go back and find that thing inside of us that brings about shame, whether it's an alcoholic father or you know, something we did in our youth that we're ashamed of, or whatever. You know, you can take this ability to shudder, and then you can go even down further with that.
So just for me, I'm just trying to figure out all the metaphors of this, because I have not read I Am John.
Okay.
And so for the example that you gave about the generals being peace activists, are you saying like that the war is the kitchen work, and the ability to shudder is the reaction from that?
Well, no, war isn't necessarily the kitchen work. The kitchen work is when you have failed. The kitchen work is when you know in your heart that you're a failure, you know. And most men go through that. There's a Japanese proverb that goes, at 10, Me and her animals at 20. They're idiots at 30. They're failures at 40s. At 40, they're liars. At 50s, they're a fraud. At 60, they begin to advise their friends. At 70, they're quiet because they know all things said are misunderstood. At 80, they begin to hold their ground. You know, so there is a mythological reason. There is a mythological understanding that at some point, all men fail.
So is kitchen work the failure itself? The kitchen work is what you have to do to get out of the failure?
No, the kitchen work is failure. Kitchen work is when you're at rock bottom, when you're working at a job that you know you can do better, that you may despise, that if your mother were there, you'd be ashamed. You know, kitchen work is when you have bottomed out, when your degree, your physical strength, your standing in society means nothing. You know, and that's where kitchen work comes in.
It's really the awareness of that, too.
It's the actual. It's more than just the awareness. It is the actuality of that. Yeah.
The awareness of it is what makes it so bad.
Exactly.
Well, yeah.
You're a natural.
I mean, if you're a janitor and you don't think you've failed, then that's fine. You know, but at some point, even if you're you know, a maintenance person, at some point you know you failed. I mean, if at some point in your life you know that you'd want to do better, that you were raised to do better, and you failed. You know, so that's kitchen work. And there are other terminology that he uses for that, ashes work, you know, working, you know, in ashes and all of that kind of thing. The sleeping with the black darling and all of that just takes you deeper and deeper down into it. And then, yes, sir. Oh, who was first?
How many men have gone through that? Fair kitchen work. Nobody that I know of that personally have.
Well, how many men will admit to it? I mean, that's part of it. How many men will admit to it? And this stuff doesn't happen necessarily at a certain age. This stuff happens oftentimes, divorces, you know. When you're confronted by an older son or older child of any kind who says, you know, you screwed me up, you failed, loss of job, loss of home, you know, it occurs oftentimes at a time of loss, and you're doing what you can do to stay afloat.
It could also be a spiritual failure too. I would think that a lot of midlife crises come on with men who are highly successful, you know, financially and things like that. But there's also a sense of failure on a personal level that brings that on. Possible?
Possible, but Bly's thing is much more realistic than that. You know, it's at a point where you are financially a failure as well. You know, it may not show up. Well, he says it's at a point where society knows you're a failure. Not only you, but society knows you're a failure. When anybody walking the street can look at you and say, this man isn't doing what he can do, you know. So that's how Bly defines it. Yes, sir.
My question, what just comes up in my mind right now after listening to all this, well, how is this different for women as opposed to men? You know, if this is specifically for men, it's like, well, wouldn't women also kind of have these doubts and fears and problems and things like that?
I don't know. And Bly doesn't address that much. He said he often says in the book, I don't know what it's like for women. You'd have to talk to women and deal with women. I know there's a book out now, a big thick book, on kind of this whole kind of thing in terms of women. I think it's called Running with the Wolves or something like that. But it kind of explains the whole thing about women. Because oftentimes this stuff for men are generally loners, where women run with the pack. And that's where the title comes from, Running with Wolves. And so men approach it differently than women. I mean, I'm sure there are parallels. I don't know what they are. And then you move from making a room from your mother's house to your father's house. And what that means to Bly is that oftentimes, and Bly's thing is that oftentimes men grow up, young boys grow up, and they side with the mother and kind of dismiss the father. The father's never at home. When the father comes home, the father's grumpy and tired. And so the mothers use that, and you never take me out anywhere, you never do this. And the kids side with the mother, and next thing you know, the mother lives in this big mansion, and the father lives in this little, you know, in this little room, metaphorically, in our minds and in our hearts. And Bly says at some point, men need to make rooms big enough for their father. And he says, you do that by talking to older men in your neighborhood or community, and your uncles and aunts, to find out what your father was really like when he was your age, when he was, you know, when he was growing up, or remembering the things that your father taught you that you use now, you know.
Is that his emphasis about the absentee father?
Yeah, that it all connects into that absentee father with the industrialization. And used to be men, even if they worked in the fields, you know, their sons worked with them, or you know, like farmers and things like that. But when the industrialization came and men, you know, took jobs away from home and were oftentimes gone and came back to eat and sleep, basically, or discipline the kids, it kind of shrunk the father's impact in the home. And that's kind of the overall emphasis there on what happens to the father. And over the years, that takes its toll, and you only see your father as a disciplinarian, or you only have an image of your father either leaving home or coming home. And you get to the point, I know in our home, it got to the point, I used to love to see my father leave. Then I could relax. It was fun again. But when he was there, it was kind of tense, because we always had to worry about, he was tired. He had worked all day. We always had to eat what he wanted to eat, and that kind of thing. But we, you know, it never got larger than that. And Bly talks about making room for your father, making the room that our fathers live in larger. Does that compute with people? Does that make sense?
One thing I see it in my family, in my wife's family, so that's a sample size of two. But we're both, you know, both the mom and the dad are working, but the mom shares more what's happened in her day. Mm-hmm. Somehow, just when you're done with dinner, and you have a better feeling of what happened with her day more than what happened with his day. Mm-hmm. Certainly my dad would just not share as much of, yeah, what went on with the work and the you know, kind of his existence, that other side of his existence, mm-hmm. like my mom would. And so, unless you have some way of getting out there and doing it with him, you're not mm-hmm. It's not gonna be as much to you.
Bly says we lose a lot by not working with our fathers, not our fathers taking us to work and showing us what they do. And in the first place, most fathers don't like what they do. Second place, what most fathers do is push papers. But, you know, in the pre-industrial days, the fathers were out there, they were blacksmiths, they were some kind of laborers where they could literally take their sons out and show them what they do. But to take your son out and just push on a computer keyboard, you know, how much fun is that? How much action is that involved? And So the key is to, one of the keys Bly talks about that fathers can do is teach their sons how to tell stories or dance or woodworking or, you know, pottery or whatever, some kind of hobby that the father can literally teach the son in terms of what fathers can do for sons. But sometimes when we come to this realization, it's too late. Our fathers are dead or very old or whatever. And for this, then that's when you gather up the stories, remember all remember the good things about your father. One of the things I remember about my father that I had long since forgotten, I remember him taking us out, showing us how to swim, you know, and you remember that, and that room gets just, you know, just a little bit bigger, you know, that sort of thing, and little things add up. You gather up pleasant stories or interesting stories that expand your father. One of the examples was a man who said that his uncle told him that his father was the only person he knew who was reading during the Depression. Nobody else was reading. Everybody else was trying to scrap a living, eke out a living, but his father still continued to read during the Depression, and this helped the son kind of make the room a little bigger for his father.
What does a person do who comes from a dysfunctional family and has no positive
images of the father? Well, you look for positive images then. I mean, if a person's father is, say, alcoholic, you know, there's a reason why that person's alcoholic. There are people around who remember when the father was an alcoholic. Very few of us at 10 years old say, when I grow up, I want to be an alcoholic. You know, at some point, hopefully there's somebody who remembers his father aside from just being an alcoholic. And sometimes you have to reach back to aunts and uncles who no longer live in the area, or buddies who were not necessarily drinking buddies or whatever, you know.
So I kind of see this as seeing your father as more than a one-dimensional creature. Like, you know, you just see dad leaves from work in the morning, gets home at night, has dinner, sits in front of the TV, goes to bed, and this sort of thing. And so maybe even if you're from a dysfunctional family, if you understand, you know, the reasons behind, you know, the situation.
Yeah. Nobody's just
also, like, I would assume you're seeing your father as more as a whole person as opposed to dad.
Yeah, nobody's dysfunctional for nothing. And even dysfunctional isn't it. That's not the whole story. Your father was somebody at 10. Your father was somebody at 15. If you can find somebody who remembers what he was like, what he enjoyed doing, if you can find people, you know, ask brothers and sisters even, what they remember. But oftentimes in our family, if there's an age span, the older one will remember something that the younger ones don't. Maybe the older ones remember when your father didn't drink so much, or when your father didn't work so much. You know, being the firstborn, maybe they remember when the father used to bounce them on their knee or something like that. You know, that kind of thing is what he talks about, making this room big enough for the father.
That, I had an experience somewhat like that a month or two ago when I spent some time with my mother. I don't consider ever having really known my father, and so there were very few positive images, but I was asking her a lot of questions about my father, and she related an interesting story. The day that I was born, was so glad that I was a male, that is to say, you know, that the son finally came, that he treated everyone to the carnival rides, and this was during, just after the war, and to hear that kind of thing was just that. It added another dimension. It kind of expanded that room. I didn't ever know that.
Yeah.
But you're always talking about the biological father, aren't you? What about the one that has to sift things out between the and divorces of stepfathers and so forth? That gets complicated, doesn't it?
It does get complicated if you don't remember your biological father. If there's no way to get in touch with your biological father or find out anything about your biological father. I had a friend of mine who had very little memories of his biological father, And he started looking up his family tree, not necessarily to get in touch with his biological father, but just because he was interested in it. And he got a lot of strength just hearing or reading about his father and the family his father came from, and their connection and all of that kind of stuff. It really broadened his room, so to speak, for his father to see all those connections, to see his father literally connected into a family and to see those connections. And then we move from that to the father's gift. And the father gives us all a gift. And we need to figure out what that gift is. What do we get from our father? Is it a sense of humor? Is it perseverance? Is it, physical makeup? There is some kind of gift that we all get from our father, and we need to get in touch with what that is and think back on what that gift is. What was the thing that either you remember or someone told you about your father that was good that is now part of you? You know, that's part of your gift. And then we move from that into this whole image of copper versus iron. A lot of us at some point become copper versus iron. And a lot of us become, if from here on back is kind of fuzzy and hazy, and we haven't connected with what it is to be men or with our fathers, we become copper. And what that is that we take on the pain of others. And by that, Bly uses the example of putting one hand on the chest of our father and one hand on the chest of our mother. And that pain that went back and forth, then we conduct it. It runs through us. You know, maybe your mother would say, you know, your father's, never takes me out, never does this, never does that. He's so lazy. He's never home, or he works too much, or whatever. And you learn just by sitting in that kitchen with your mother or wherever to be conductor of that pain. Bly talks about, and this isn't in his book, this is in another book I read by him, but he talks about boys learn at a certain age that if we're nice, it's okay. If we're nice, our mothers like us and other girls like us if we're nice. And our fathers, since they're never around, it's no big deal. But we realize that if we're just nice, women like us. Where on the other hand, being nice doesn't get women anywhere with other women. So women start fighting with their mothers from the beginning. So Bly uses this as to say the women have their witch about them. And the witch is not necessarily female. The witch is that ability to fight. And he says that women have their witches from day one, and they practice with their mothers. So women grow up knowing how to fight because they fight with their mothers. Men don't know how to fight. So, and we do our fighting in dysfunctional ways, either just at the office or in war or rape or pillage or something of that effect. But that we somehow learn that if we're nice, our mothers are happy with that. So then we become conductors. We put our hand on our mother's chest and on our father's chest and conduct that energy. Or we put our hands on our mother's chest and one to the ground if there's no man around, and that energy goes there. But we become conductors for all kinds of energy. But we never become what he talks about being iron, which is where Iron John comes from, which is being iron, which is to accept our own energy and go with our own energy. So, and for Bly, this is what he calls, and he really kind of rags on these people in his book, new age people or soft males, people who are conductors. And he oftentimes throws pastors in this, pastors, psychiatrists, counselors, priests. He throws us all in that bucket, these soft males who, you know, sit and listen to stuff all day long, who are, say all the right things. I hear what you're saying. I understand that. You know, how does this feel? How does that feel? And we never get in touch with our own feelings, and we become, you know, conductors of other people's energy, other people's anger, other people's sadness, particularly that of women. We become, in order to be accepted by women, in order to be considered nice by women, we accept that energy.
So, but what's the alternative?
Me? No, the alternative is to which moves us into the next one, to choose. The alternative is to decide who you want to be or what you want to do, and then choose that. And then he says, choose it and then pay for it with your life. To choose where you want to go, what you want to be, what you want to be about, and then to pay for that with your life, meaning that you do all you can do to be that, you know. And you don't let people dissuade you by saying, oh, that's not nice, or you're not understanding enough, or you're not this enough or that enough. You choose it and pay for it with your life. And he talks about there are people who will marry us if we're copper, and they will, and then they'll begin to eat away at our soul. And that iron, if something's iron, then people can't eat away at it. You know, does that answer your question?
I need an example, I guess.
Well, okay. If you wanted to be a counselor, and that was what you chose to do, and to give your life to it, it doesn't sound like he's giving you that option.
Well, he is giving you an option. If you want to be a counselor, you know, you can accept women's pain, but at some point you put a stop to it. You say, okay, I worked at the office today, you know, from 8 to 5, that's it. You don't go to the bar and sit there and listen to a woman's pain. You don't go out with your woman or your wife and then sit there and be a conductor of her pain, you know. At some point, which means you control it, at some point you say, okay, I hear all this, all the bad stuff, and then at 8:30, let's call an end to it and go to a movie. Or something to that effect. You don't let people do that to you. Yeah.
I think also it's I think Blythe describes it as the ability to ask questions. Our mothers teach us that it's not polite to question people when we're children. And he's generalizing, of course. But the father teaches us that we definitely need to learn to ask questions instead of just accepting everything at face value. And there's a wonderful book by Robert Johnson called He, or The Myth of the Psychology of the Male. And he talks about the myth of Parsifal, where he wears his mother's slip throughout, underneath the armor of that he wears. And he doesn't ask the right question halfway through the story. And he can't ask the right question until he takes off his mother's slip at the end of the story. And it's basically just being able to have the courage to question authority, to question the status quo. And know what is right in your heart.
Yeah.
And yet here's this fellow, Dr. James Dobson. He writes a book, What Wives Wish Their Husbands Knew About Women. And, you know, there again, we're supposed to know. And it comes up, but it would be almost in contradiction to what this fellow says.
Yeah, and there's a lot of information out there that's contradiction to this, you know. And there's a lot of stuff out there calling men to be soft males, calling men. And this doesn't mean that you're a brute. You know, what this means is that, you know, you don't, there are places women go, men can't go and shouldn't go. There are places men go, women can't go and shouldn't go. Society's full of that. There are things our children do we don't need to know about. You know, there are things that we've done our children don't need to know about. You know, so the world is full of that kind of stuff. And so all Bly is saying is that there are some places with women you cannot go. And for women, particularly, it's the sadness and the pain. Men cannot get into that sadness and pain, just like women cannot get into our sadness and our pain. You know, he says, some men have taken on the pain of the women's 2,000 years of being abused, you know, and men can't do that. We simply can't do that. Just like women can't take on what it is to be a man, the bad things about being a man, the things that are hurtful for us, you know, you know, the blaming that goes. He says women and men can shame each other very easily. And that, so don't get yourself in a position where you allow a woman to shame you, or anybody for that matter, but that men and women can shame each other quick. And that to be aware of when you're being shamed or when you're so far down a road of someone else's pain or sadness that you begin to absorb it into yourself. There's a difference between empathy and actually taking it on. And then we're short for time, so let me push through this. And then any questions? The expression of one's vision, and then that takes us to the wild man. And the wild man is that we go back to the little boy. The 1 or 2 year old, 2 or 3 year old boy is our wild man. The 1, 2 or 3 year old knows exactly what they want and what they want to do, and they do it. If it wasn't for adults, they'd continue to do it. And this is one where Bly says we get into trouble because a lot of people try to become the wild man. He says that's not the issue. To become the wild man leads to confusion and an early death. You know, people try to become Jesus. You know, people try to become, you know, some wild. And, you know, we all know stories of people who literally smoke and drink and fought themselves to an early grave. You know, movie stars, other entertainers, rock stars, you know, people who die early because they're just wild, you know. And Bly's thing is you relate to the wild man, you do not become the wild man. And then you have a sword. And with that sword, you fight for your wild man. And you fight to continue to relate and connect to your wild man. And then he says that never give a person a sword who doesn't know how to dance. And by that, he means if you don't know how to have a good time, if you don't know how to be jovial and lighten up and enjoy life, then if you get a hold of a sword, you're going to take out a whole community. You know, that there needs to be this ability to, you know, to get in touch with, you know, with the grief and the high, you know, the fun stuff of life equally before you take on your sword. And then the ceremony of the passage, and that is just the ability to, you know, enjoy where you are and have a party, invite people over. You can celebrate who you are in your life and what you do and that sort of thing. Yeah.
We watched a blind tape once with
Moyer,
psychiatrist. Yeah, Moyer tape. And there's a men's group, a group of men that were interested in this. And a lot of it seemed to relate to separating from the woman, from the mother. Mm-hmm. Because this group that got together to discover their maleness, we spent the whole first session talking about women.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, the leader pointed that out. Mm-hmm. That's our basic hang-up, mm-hmm. is that we still are hung up on the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother's breast and all this. And that's why we still have trouble getting together as men. We end up talking about women instead of about ourselves.
Yeah.
We have trouble talking about ourselves.
And women have that same problem. I mean, but we Yeah, we do. We get together and we talk about women. We talk about a lot of us have transferred, you know, from our mother to our wives. Of course, that's very common. And so, and Bly's thing is not to forget about the woman, but to develop yourself apart from, in connection necessarily with women. Any other questions?
What do you think, stepping back, because you've thought a lot about it, stepping back and you've maybe seen some of the criticisms from the feminist camp or whatever, because I haven't read the book and listened to these tapes and stuff. But stepping back, what do you think of the criticisms of this movement?
I know there's a lot of charlatans out here. I prefer Bly's book. It's very metaphorical. And a lot of us are more used to thinking linear than circular, metaphorical kind of thought. But the women's movement, to me, just emphasizes what he says about women being able to shame men, when people of the opposite sex shaming one another. The fact that women look at this and they see all kinds of things wrong with it. They blame us for all kinds of things. And I don't think Bly is taking anything away from women. Bly is speaking strictly to men on how men can take care of ourselves and then in the process begin to take care of humanity and the world we live in. But feminists look at him and they see him blaming women. You know, the whole thing about the golden ball, the story about the golden ball is that at some point he's got to go get the pillow, get the key from under his mother's pillow. And that's scary to the boy. Why that's scary is because everybody knows that your mother is not going to give you the key to be wild. You know, your mother will give you the key if you say you want to be a doctor or a lawyer, someone tame who works for, quote, the system or the corporation. But she's not going to give you the key if you say you want to go and be a wild man. The only way you can get that key is to steal that key. Well, that pisses women off, you know, that you're going to go steal something from women. You blame women for holding on to this key and you're going to steal something from you. But women want you to be what suits their needs, just like we want women to be what suits our needs. And we're both saying now, we don't want to do that anymore, you know. So I don't pay much attention to what feminists say about this because it simply isn't for women. And that's all right, you know. There are lots of things that go on in the feminist camp that isn't for us. And that's what being a feminist or in touch with the opposite sex is about. It's just getting out of the way and letting them set their agenda and do what they feel they need to do, you know. So, and I don't see Bly blaming women. I don't see Bly telling men to go out and do anything to women but get out of their way. Yes, sir.
In other words, he's saying women should be tender, but they shouldn't be whips.
Yeah. All right. Thank you all.
Thank you.
If you can leave your pens there, and I'll pick them up.
Gave me a copy.
I guess you didn't use your papers.
You must have something wrong with me. I can't think metaphorically. I was reading that we book and that you book on the website.
It is hard for me to think.